Thank you, Leslie, and thank you, Kathy, and thank you, the family, and thank you, all the friends. Wonderful. Incredibly sad, in a sense, to be here, but also a real privilege to be here. And it's truly a celebration. It feels like family, actually. It's Ellie's extended, big, loving, wonderful family. It was fantastic, Leslie, that you put Ellie's voice on, because that opens up our memories and it opens up our imagination. And I listened very carefully to what he said, and it reminded me of the kick that there always was in what Ellie said. I wrote down a quote, this is talking about Edward St. George and the commitment to the building. Edward honored his commitment, pause, in large part. And it so reminded me of the conversations that I had with Ellie over so many years. He had a way of communicating insights, observations, a kick up the backside, in a wonderful and generous way. He was a very kind person in how he dealt with all of us, and that's come across, I think, as everyone has spoken. Ellie was my teacher. He was my employer. He was my colleague. He became my mentor. And finally, he was my friend. And as I think about my relationship with Ellie, I really divide it into sort of three chapters. It came in three parts, not quite as long as with Roslyn or Steve or Judge Awada or others who've really known him for a very long time. I only knew him for 35 years. I met him in 1982. He taught me on the LLM program. And he was a wonderful and inspiring teacher. And the fact that he loved the International Court made us love the International Court. The fact that he so evidently relished the subject which he had the privilege to be involved in made us love that subject. And that sense of connection never disappeared. After I did my LLM, I went off to America for a year with a then girlfriend. And in the spring of 1984, completely out of the blue, I received a letter in one of Ellie's beautifully typed envelopes. He used this light blue, thick, heavy notepaper, and the envelopes were always beautifully typed. And it described that he was in the process of setting up a center for international law. And since I had done reasonably well in my LLM, would I be interested in applying for a position as the first research fellow at the center? The letter came out of the blue. I'd had very little contact with Ellie after I left. But at my graduation, and I'll come back to why this may be significant, my grandparents from Paris came to that graduation, and they met Ellie, and they met Rachel, who was a very important person in Ellie's life. And I'll explain later why I think that may have been significant. So I did indeed apply. I don't think there were, I was in the days of pre-advertisements. I don't know who else applied. I don't know anyone else who applied or who was even interviewed, but somehow I got the job. It was paid £1,000 a quarter, plus room and board, which I thought was fantastic. And for 4 years, I worked with Ellie on a project on state contracts, which gave me my introduction to the world of ICSID and investment treaties. And I can absolutely share the experience of doing a text. My role started off, it was a very simple job. It was to summarize these piles of old cases that Ellie had gathered. And I just have this memory of sitting in Ellie's wonderful study and him just tearing apart my summaries. They were just completely inadequate. By the time he had finished with my one-page summary, it was just covered in his, you know, ink pen. He had completely rewritten. I think, looking back, I really learnt at that moment over 4 years the beginnings of how to write and how important it was to present information. And he had a real generosity about spending the time with you. You would sit with him for hours, a real teacher, and just teach you how to connect ideas. Use very short sentences. Make sure your punctuation is done properly. And I've never forgotten that experience. He was an incredibly inspiring teacher. And I think that, I'll come back to it, was part of what I think is his greatest legacy in terms of that ability to teach and to inspire. In the midst of that four-year term, the Chernobyl accident happened in the former Soviet Union in a part of Ukraine. And I got an invitation to deliver a paper in Washington on the legal aspects of Chernobyl. A lesser mentor than Eli Lauterpacht would have said, there's no international law in that, don't bother. International environmental law didn't exist in 1986 as a subject. He said, do it. It's great. It's interesting. It's different. I don't know anything about it, he said. I'll learn something about it. Go and find out what rules govern that kind of situation. And so I went off and, with his support, then published my first book about Chernobyl and international law, which then led to a treatise on international environmental law. And I think very much of Eli, for me, as the inspiration behind my taking certain decisions. And I said again, other people would have said, no, don't waste your time with that stuff. You know, there's no law there, it's not going anywhere. Eli had an open mind, and that open, inquisitive, curious mind allowed him to encourage others, even if it wasn't his interest, to follow their instincts and to follow their subject. So I left in 88, went down to London. He had already said by then, you must join the bar. And when Eli says, you must join the bar, you join the bar. I didn't know anyone at the bar. He helped me join an inn. I didn't really have no legal contacts at all. And he was incredibly supportive. And slowly over the years, we started to work on occasional cases. I can't say anything else that hasn't already been said on the big cases before the big international courts and tribunals. What I loved about Eli was that he'd take instructions on the tiniest of cases, if it had an interesting point. So I was instructed and then brought him in on a case that I thought he'd never want to do, a case none of you here will have heard of, the Nirex case. It was before a planning inquiry in the northwest of England. And it was an inquiry in relation to a proposal by the United Kingdom to create a waste depository for spent nuclear fuel under the Irish Sea in part. And Eli said, absolutely, I want to do it. Absolutely, count me in, let's do it. And we were instructed by the Attorney General of Ireland. And I had my own screensaver experience, a slightly different one. I mean, Eli, he was wonderfully supportive, but he had a formal side to him, and he had a certain sense of protocol and correctness, and also a certain sense of hierarchy. And as we went into the first consultation, he said to me, Philippe, just make sure you don't say anything until I've given you the okay to do so. At a certain point in the consultation, which went on for a number of hours, I noticed that Eli did that impression of being asleep, which we all know and love. But I didn't know him that well, so I was worrying a little. When the Attorney General posed a question to him, and I'm thinking, what do I do? He's told me not to speak unless he's given me the go-ahead. He appears not to be awake. And then he did exactly as you said. He had been awake all the time. He's just, you know, listening quietly, getting a bit of shut eye, and immediately straight on the point. So I know exactly what it is you're talking about. That experience went on. I second absolutely what Chris Greenwood said about the pleading in the nuclear test case. I cite that in my classes. We use it as a teaching tool. It is the best piece of forensic advocacy I have ever had the privilege to see in an international court on the facts, because it was on the facts. And that was, I think, the crucial aspect about Eli that distinguished him from many other public international lawyers, was Eli wasn't frightened to roll up his sleeves and get involved on the muck of facts. And on nuclear stuff, you needed to do that. And he was willing to do that. And the brilliance of that pleading, those submissions before the International Court, is that he knew his dossier inside out. No junior had written for him the final words that he wrote. I was in court that day. I saw it delivered. I saw the effect. I absolutely buy Chris's point that it was not the easiest of arguments. But he did it with absolute brilliance. And from that, again, we learned. Whilst all this is going on, I got to spend some time also in that wonderful study, and I saw and heard, as we all did, some pretty amazing things. Because we'd be in there, the phone would ring. And my abiding memory of some of the most hilarious moments that I've had with Ellie. And the great thing about Ellie is there's always a lot of laughter. There's a lot of warmth and laughter, and you remember the smile and the mischievous twinkle in the eye. Phone rings, and I hear the following. How do you spell that name? H-A-L-F-O-N. And who do you say you are? Motion Picture Producers Association of the United States.
Correct.
And you want a reference for him. I start waving at Ellie because the person concerned had been a quote-unquote LLM student. I don't know if Chris is in the room, but Chris may remember the story. Supposedly at Magdalen College, and he was going to be on the Cambridge University Telders International Law Moot competition. So it was my job to find out whether the college would be willing to support in some amount the trip to The Hague to participate in the Telders. I called Chris. He said he's not a student at Magdalen. And it turned out he was a complete imposter. Had obtained a blue from the university, but had never enrolled and had turned up at all of our classes. But Ellie, of course, had continued without knowing any of this to have a relationship with him because he didn't know what had gone on and because he was generous and supportive of his pupils, as I was one. That working life went on until we get to the final chapter in my relationship with Ellie, the, in a sense, the most important and, in a sense, the most intimate. A chapter that opened when I received an invitation in the spring of 2010 to give a lecture at an obscure university in an obscure part of the Ukraine, a place called Lviv, on the work that I had done on crimes against humanity and genocide. I accepted the invitation for the simple reason that my grandfather happened to have been born in that city, and I wanted to go and find out what it was like. I spent a part of the summer of 2010 doing research on the origins of crimes against humanity and genocide, and discovered, to my astonishment, that the person who'd been at the heart of it was Hirsch Lauterpacht. I had no idea. I'd sat in the Lauterpacht room in the Squire Library. We'd seen that plaque. We knew what a great international lawyer he was. I had no idea what he had done. So, of course, the first person that I turn to when I make this discovery is Ellie. And at the time, Andrew was working with Ellie. And Ellie just opened his doors completely with that characteristic sense of generosity, of sharing completely anything he had that might be helpful, not with a sense of ownership or propriety, but one of his pupils was doing a piece of work and he wanted to assist that pupil. That was the commitment that Ellie had over time. And so I got to spend, over the course of the following 5 years, very significant periods of time with Ellie, talking not about cases, not about international law, not about all of the fantastic things we've all been talking about, but about Ellie and his father. And I think the key to understanding Ellie, I've now come to appreciate, is about that relationship with Hirsch. In a sense, my words follow on from James's, but from a different perspective, because I had the privilege to sit with Ellie and ask him questions about his relationship with his father, questions that were not easy for him to engage in. This was a conversation that emerged over 5 years and started very gently. I come from a family background that has a similar story to his, and I've understood that between the generations, these aspects raise matters that are difficult, delicate, people either do or don't want to talk about them, and it's entirely a matter for them. But Ellie wanted to talk about it. Ellie wanted to talk about his mother and his father. And I think, as I've sat here listening today, I've come to realize even more that the key to understanding who Ellie was, who Ellie is, what motivated him, what really caused him to tick, was that absolutely crucial relationship. Early this morning, I went back over the transcripts. I recorded many of our interviews. And I just want to share with you one of them, because it just, for me, reflects the Ellie that I knew and love. I had asked him to go back slightly on history. You need to recall that Ellie was born in 1928. His father had been in England then for a few years, married to Rachel. They move up to Cambridge in 1937. The war breaks out in 1939. It's brilliantly captured in exquisite detail in the biography, which is an extraordinary piece of work. I mean, absolutely extraordinary piece of work. And Ellie is 11 when the war breaks out, and he has some memories of what has happened, and he's willing, it seems, to share them with me. But of course, there is a darkness, a greater darkness to the whole story, which is that there remain in Lviv and in nearby Zhulkiev many members of his family. Hirsch's mother and father, Hirsch's brother, Hirsch's sister, a huge number of cousins and nephews and uncles and aunts. And of course, I learn, speaking with Ellie, who, like my mother, opens the door and wants to talk about these things and wants to encourage me to write about them, that Ellie grew up, as many people did from that period, in a period of silence. He didn't know the details. In a sense, I became a surrogate, looking for things that he hadn't known. So against that background, I asked him at one point a question. I'm just reading a quote from a transcript. What consciousness, I asked, did you have about another family living outside England? On my father's side, Ellie replies, I was aware, of course, that he had family in Poland. His parents came to visit us twice, I believe. I can only remember 1935, when he begged them to stay. And they wouldn't, because his brother and his sister were still in Poland, and they didn't want to leave. But what I remember about my relationship with my father was that it was a very loving relationship. It wasn't an intellectual relationship, of course, at that age. But I do remember my father, my mother, and I. We used to dance around the room to music. I think it was Bizet's Carmen. And then Ellie sings, la la, la la, la la, la la, and he goes on. It was that sort of relationship. My mother, of course, looked after me. She was the one who put me to bed. I don't remember him, for example, reading to me particularly. My mother would read the children's books to me. Then I got a bit older, and I came out of King Alfred's school, and then I was sent to Peterborough Lodge, a school in Hampstead, where I was very unhappy, for some reason I don't know, and then they took me away, and then I went to another school, the Hall, where I was much better off. My relationship with my father wasn't a very intense relationship in my second, third, and fourth years. But as soon as I got into the bigger school, and for example, had to begin learning Latin, we would go for walks in Gladstone Park, down Melrose Avenue from Walden Lane, and we'd go through my Latin declensions and conjugations together. I remember we would recite, amo, amas, amat. I can't do it anymore, but he'd make me do that, on and on and on, and he'd be very, very insistent. And I think the key for me in my relationship with Ellie and with Kathy, who's been just a central person holding my hand as I've gone through this and for whom I'm intensely grateful, equally grateful, to understand Ellie, it's really about his relationship with his father. As James has said, his father was intellectually and in the world of international law a truly exceptional and remarkable human being and international lawyer. And I think Ellie worked out that for him to be a truly exceptional and wonderful international lawyer, which he was, he would need to do it in a different way. And he did it in a different way. And he did it equally brilliantly, as James has described, but following a different path. And so his legacy, I think, is all of the people in the room, the 700 people who've passed through the Lauterpacht Center, the thousands of people who studied with him, and of course the Lauterpacht Center. It's a legacy of little sparkling lights supportive of international law around the entire globe, who are infused with his sense of possibility, of optimism, and of absolute commitment to integrity, to independence of spirit, and to a rule of international law. That's the Elie that I love deeply, and I think we all really miss him. Thank you.